Red Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 58th BFI London Film Festival, and I'm joined by filmmaker Jerry Fox, who's presenting his documentary Mark Quinn, Making Waves. So thanks very much for being with us, first of all.
Not at all. It's a pleasure to be on your radio station.
Well, I think it's a pleasure to have you, and to be talking about this film, which I watched a few days ago. But would you like to introduce it for our listeners, first of all?
This is a film which follows an artist, a famous artist, a well-known, commercially successful contemporary artist called Mark Quinn, who's part of the Britpop generation of artists, Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, all that gang. And I made this film which follows him over the course of a year in his life. And it follows him making new works, which you actually see him having the idea a couple of times on camera, so you really do see the creative moment of its beginning, and then you follow those works as they are reach fruition in the studio, and then are made in foundries and places, and then put on show and sold. So you see the whole process of contemporary art, and you watch this over a number of works, and you see him flitting around the world, going to exhibitions, to museums. The life of the artist, that's what it's about.
It's been a while since I've seen a film about an artist that really looks at it, like, from close up. And but first of all, I'd like to know, like, how did you meet Mark Quinn? I mean, do you guys go way back, or...?
We do go quite far back now, because we have made two films together in the past. The first film was a short film which I produced. I didn't actually direct that one. I produced it, and it became famous on British television because he actually made a sculpture, his own head, made out of his own shit, basically. I hope you can say that on your...
You can say whatever you want.
You saw him producing the stuff, molding it, making it, and so it became kind of a legendary thing. And out of that, I got the idea that we could make quite a fabulous stylized movie together for television, which we then did for the South Bank show, where we kind of created this idea of an artist falling into one of his own works, which was a tank of frozen silicon, and then going on this crazy journey into his creative subconscious. It's about as opposite to this film that you just seen as is possible to be. It was all created, stylized, you know, actors. We even had James Bond in it, you know, Daniel Craig was in it. They were, you know, and it was all like a mad journey, a kind of almost surreal sort of journey into the creative subconscious. So we had that history, and as a result of making those two films, we've become quite good friends and discussed, art together, went on holidays. So we were actually quite good friends, which I think allowed him to trust me to do this. I don't think he would have let anybody else do it. So it gave me that head start, and I could tease him a bit. I could ask him a few questions that other people might get cross. You know, it allowed me to do the film I wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, you say that this film it might have been the opposite of that film that you mentioned, but nevertheless, this is also kind of a journey in itself, isn't it? It's a kind of an exposure of the art world that we don't usually see.
Absolutely, it's unquestionably a journey with an artist to uncover all the aspects of the life of the artist, which isn't just about creating the work. It's about how you work out what to say about the work, how you get it on show in the right places, how you sell it, how you travel the world, building the brand as much as anything. The brand of these artists, whether it's Tracy Emin or Jeff Koons or Mark Quinn and Damien Hirst, they have to build this brand in order to sell. And so it's a journey in that world, definitely. And that's in the journey section of the London Film Festival. So I guess they felt that.
It suited. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I loved everybody just for that, because I mean, not only do we get close insight, but also some things that I never thought were happening, but probably, and you know, looking back on it, I should have known. Because the things that happen in it, some of the things that are quite surreal in the way that art is actually projected. But I was wondering, you seen as you knew Mark Quinn quite well, did you find out anything about him through this journey, by taking this journey venture, that you might not have known and that might have influenced this documentary in a wider sense?
It's a good question. I knew him quite well, and because I'd made films with him, I knew a lot of the process that went on. I think one of the things I did learn was that, you know, that he really goes for it in lots of different ways and takes chances in new avenues of art form, which some people find quite difficult to, because he's not doing the same thing all the time. And he does try to paint, even though he's not a painter. He tries to do things with paint. Right. He tries to do things, you know, the splattering technique. You know, he's constantly trying to come up with ideas. And I notice the way he'll, you know, he draws on other artists and other things and then develops into different ways. You know, the way that the artist works. I mean, the other aspects of it, I sort of knew that that's what you had to do, but it was still an insight into seeing how you go about selling the work to Elton John, and how you go about selling it to an Arab sheikh, and you know the different ways you do that. So I was quite fascinated to see how you. I wasn't sure at the beginning I was going to be, so it was a pleasant surprise.
Exactly. So there wasn't much planned. It was just really all happening, and as it happened, you kind of got an idea of how to cut it.
Exactly. And I cut it as we went along because of the amount of material that we were building up. I realized if I didn't keep cutting to keep producing. Obviously, you carried on once it was all finished, but you had to, in my opinion, to otherwise it might have almost been, you know, insurmountable. I just might have given up because it was just so much. Whereas by editing in stages, it allowed me to get on top of the material and keep getting an idea of what I was doing.
Now, this is a technique of filmmaking that we're familiar with from the 60s, and nowadays it does get used, but sometimes it's hard to really remain true to the subject, and we've seen it used, you know, in recent times even, where it doesn't really remain faithful to the subject. I think that doesn't happen in this film. I think it really works for that reason. So what are really the positive aspects of working with in such a style of filmmaking, whereas, you know, you might have documentaries that are more structured from the get-go?
Well, this is the first time I've always made structured films. So, in a way, this was a real leap into the dark for me, and filming it all myself, which wasn't easy. I mean, I forgot to turn the microphone on. I thought was in focus was not in focus. Batteries ran out at the wrong time, and you know, the memory card ran out just as Elton John bought the bloody work. You know, all this sort of thing that made it quite hair raising in an odd sort of way. But what it did give you was an intimacy and an unobtrusiveness that you could never have with a big film crew following him around. It was just me, and so I could put the camera right by his face, you know. And people forgot about me because they know me, or they know I'm a friend of his. And it was a Canon 5D camera, so it looks like a stills camera. So a lot of people thought I was just holding it. They think I was taking pictures or just holding the camera. Yeah. So I had a sort of freedom that I'd never had before.
There's a piece in the documentary where you're actually told off because of that reason, probably, because they keep asking you, are you with the press?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you ever encounter problems like that, where that aren't on film? Was there any particular problems?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you say, Elton John, like, who the hell is this guy? And before that Elton John one started, or was it? Yes, I think it was. Or was it the there was a sort of Arab shape beforehand? All the bouncers came up to me and are like pushing me away, going, "Who the hell are you?" And I had to sort of say to Mark, you know, and you may remember that there was a moment where the Queen appeared and I was told to bugger off a few times. So I did, yeah.
You had to bugger off.
I found it a bit embarrassing. I mean, I think if you're in your 20s and you're sort of, doesn't matter, but you know, I'm not exactly a kid, and so it was quite a new thing to suddenly be people going, you know, "You go away, who the hell are you?" You know, I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry."
Now, was there ever moments where Mark Quinn himself told you that he needed his space, or was he totally open to revealing every aspect of his own life, even personal life?
He was pretty good, but look, there are, you know, I'm going to be completely honest, there are presumably things that he doesn't want filmed because they're, you know, they're private financial negotiations and, you know, it's a balance. I mean, you can't go into somebody's life and sort of destroy the fabric of what they do, which, like in anybody's thing, requires some things to be confidential. So there were occasionally moments where he'd just do, you know, make a little mark of me, which meant you can't really film this because it's sort of tricky. And you know, you understand that. But by and large, I got moments of everything. You know, you saw moments where people did buy the work, or you kind of got it. Really.
Well, I mean, you don't need to see the negotiations in itself, really.
Boring. It's boring. You realize that occasionally you would try and film that stuff, and it's like, oh.
Is there any more projects between the two of you? Do you have anything in the works, or do you have anything in the works that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, no, I think it'll be a break now. Mark,
oh yeah, it was that intense.
Well, it's quite intense just to keep up the energy, to keep going for over a year, endlessly driving around or flying here or there with him, and you know, it's quite ill.
And actually, we get to see that in the film, because that's another big part. Your interactions, you're taking digs at him sometimes.
Exactly, and I tease him a bit or whatever. Yeah. But I'm doing a film which oddly enough, has been going on for 12 years with a very great American video artist called Bill Viola, which I'm hoping will be at this festival next year. And it's 12 years in the making, because he's been making this thing in St. Paul's Cathedral. It's like this big permanent video screen installation on either side of the altar. It's a huge thing in St. Paul's, and it changed St. Paul's Cathedral. And I started it in 2005, and I'm still going. And it should be out next year. And it's like a sort of boyhood, you know, Boyhood, the movie, in reverse. I mean, you watch a man changing as he gets a bit older, and all the elements of his life. And it's a wonderful film. It's all shot on film. It's again sort of slightly the opposite of this. It's film crews, and you know.
Yeah, but it sounds fascinating. Yeah. It sounds fascinating. Yeah. The evolution of a work of art and the evolution of the artist.
Exactly.
So now I really enjoyed this film, and I'm sure that there'll be people that really want to see it. How are we doing on distribution? And is there any will it be screened in the big theaters? Or anything at all?
It's sitting with some distributors. I suspect some of it will depend on how well it sort of plays here in the festival. So the London Film is a great sort of, you know, it's not a big budget Hollywood movie, so you've got to start small and hope that, you know, one, it was great that it got into the festival, and got to hope that people are interested and might pick it up. But we're hoping. Do you think it would play in the cinema? I mean,
I think it has it definitely has an audience. But this one, there's something different about it. It's a different insight. That's less trying to be like the artist himself, more like showing.
Very good point. I wanted a show rather than tell. You know, I could have laid it up with a lot of voiceover of people, him talking. I wanted to get away from that and just show you the other, so you could make up your own mind.
One more question. The title, Making Waves, can we explain where the title came from?
Well, you saw also there was a lot of work, the shells, the water in Venice. There's a lot of references to water and everything. And then at the end, he explains that final one, which is actually making a wave. So, you know, he's trying to make sculpture of a wave. And I like that. So there was this sort of literal thing of him working with water, and there were waves and water, you know. And then also the idea that he, as an artist, does try to make waves. He tries to ruffle people. That great big Alison Lapa thing in Venice, you know, that made waves. It became the most talked about thing in Venice. You know?
That's even like a metaphor. Yeah. Thanks very much. It was a real pleasure talking with you. And I hope to see your film getting proper distribution.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, and this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.